Welcome to the Unstoppable Entrepreneur Show with Robin Johnson. Robin is a speaker, a teacher, a coach, an author, and an experienced seller on Amazon. Robin is known for her no-fluff, actionable advice for your business. Robin started her business with only $100 and less than 5 years later, built a seven-figure business, selling first on Craigslist, then on eBay and Amazon. Now, without waiting anymore, here's Robin Johnson, the Unstoppable Entrepreneur.
This is the Unstoppable Entrepreneur Show, where we give you actionable advice for your e-commerce business. And I want you to pretend just for a moment that you were as cool as Jeff Bezos and that you wanted to create a private label brand, but you wanted to do it at a level of quality that was consistent with Amazon's brand. Wouldn't it be cool to be able to access the people that create things for Amazon Basics? Because that's the highest level. And that's who I have on the show today, not only talking about branded products and how to exceed your customers' expectation, but also how to stay on Amazon's good graces. I have some amazing ladies from thinkcascadia.com. It's Cascadia Seller Solutions. And I have Rachel Greer, Kelly Johnston, and Emily Murray on the show today to share about not only how can you create a brand, but how can you really excel on Amazon in your service and in making sure that we keep our main customer, Amazon, happy. So thank you guys so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having us. So, yes, definitely glad to be here.
When I heard Rachel speak for the first time, I think I told her this on the phone the other day, like I was like, she is so cool. She knows all of the things. How did she get to know all of the things? And so, Rachel, if we could kind of start with you, can you kind of give us a little bit of background on because you used to work at Amazon creating some of these amazing products that I use all the time. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially with such an amazing introduction. Now I have to prove that I know all of the things. So we did, when I first started with Amazon Basics in 2012, the brand had been around for about 3, maybe 4 years at that point and was already quite successful in the three-figure millions. And by the time I left that team a couple of years later, it was beyond three-figure millions. So it was a very successful brand. And the way that Amazon takes on basically private labeling as a concept with Amazon Basics, it has different brands where there's different brand identities. But for Amazon Basics, the concept is to take a really well-selling item, something that has good seller rank, good reviews, but there's something maybe that could be made slightly better. Then they take that item, they make it and either make it slightly better or exactly the same and then charge a little bit less. So that's the brand identity for Amazon Basics, is you get the same quality of product or maybe slightly better, but at a lower cost than the national brand competitor. So that's the approach with Amazon Basics. With other brands, it was more about higher end quality, but still cheaper than, say, if you were going to Restoration Hardware. Or it could have been something where they were focused on a uniform type approach, where it was just a really standard basic product that they could do better because they're Amazon, they could get more for a lower cost and then pass those savings on to the consumer. So the approach for brands on Amazon was really focused on making sure that the customer expectation was met. And I think this is what I've seen is the biggest missing piece of a lot of the folks who are trying to do branded goods on Amazon as sellers, is they're not thinking about how to operationalize customer experience. And for me, what that means is you need to make sure that you're in the right factory, for one. Being part of the right factory doesn't just mean finding someone on Alibaba who speaks good English. That is not the best way to find a good factory. But then once you have the factory, then how do you make sure that the product that you're buying from them is actually the same level of quality as the product that you're trying to benchmark off of? Obviously, you're selling something because Jungle Scout or another tool has told you that it's selling well. Well, why is it selling well? It's not just selling well because it's a widget. It's selling well because it's a widget which has features and which has particular marketing to make it attractive to the customer. So you need to be able to figure out what is attractive to the customer about that widget and then make yours better. So that's the area that I see as a kind of gaping hole, I guess, in a lot of the literature and knowledge about doing your own brand on Amazon, is really making sure that the quality is reasonable, and doing quality control, doing product testing is not negotiable. You have to do it. Another area that I see is that people will know that they do quality control, and so they'll hire independent inspectors to save costs. So the independent inspectors cost between $100 and $150. and a proper accredited inspector will cost around $300 to have an inspection done for the day. And so folks are like, well, it's a third of the cost. Of course, I'm going to go with the cheap guy. This makes so much more sense. But the problem is that when you have basically an independent inspector, those people are making quite a lot less money than the ones who work for the lab. They're less consistent with their income. And so they're a lot less likely to be resistant to bribes, just put it that way. So sometimes you'll have one of these smaller outfits go out and inspect your goods. The inspection passes. Everything's really great. It looks good. And then you start getting complaints from customers because it wasn't actually the quality that you expected because that inspector got bought off to give a passing report. So I always recommend my clients use only accredited labs to do the inspections just because that's the best way to do it. And what we're really focused on at Cascadia is doing your own brand on Amazon the right way, doing it in such a way that even though you don't have the funds of a large retail organization, you can still create a product that looks like it came from a large retail organization. And that's really where we think brands can do such a good job on Amazon, as to the level that you can actually grow a brand presence and then start moving off of Amazon into other channels.
So what you guys really provide is not only like just get a product and sell it, but how do you create a brand that you, maybe you can even take outside of Amazon? Maybe you can sell it on Jane.com or you could sell it on your Shopify store, but to really create a product that has a high level of attractiveness, whether it be something that has a higher level of demand and maybe you're able to compete on price, or you focus in on some sort of other thing that makes it attractive, like it being having a unique feature set or some other unique selling proposition that will attract buyers to that product and to make that product. And then also to make sure that once you find that product that you want, that you're not going to end up with a zillion returns and then your account in review or things having to do with upset customers because you kind of try to cheap out on $100 and now you're out $1,000 in the cost of returns.
Yep, exactly. And I like to say that when you're ordering from China, when you're working with a Chinese manufacturer, you either pay up front or you pay on the back end. You're either going to be paying them up front to make sure the quality control is good and make sure that what the shipment is exactly what it needs to be, or you're paying on the number of returns you get sent back. So when a lot of times people are calculating their upfront cost to get started, they're not calculating in the back end at all. So they're not even thinking about, well, what if my return rate is 5%? What if my return rate is 10%? At what point does it no longer make sense to offer this item without quality control? They're not even making that particular risk determination. They're just not doing it. And that, I think, is the biggest problem, because if you've done the evaluation to say, okay, if I'm going to do the quality control on this item, I will not be able to make money because it's such a cheap item and I'm competing entirely on price and I'm okay with 5% returns. Okay, that's fine. But if you haven't even done that analysis to say, all right, I can either pay for the quality control up front, or here's my average cost in terms of negative reviews and lost sales plus cost of processing returns. If that analysis hasn't been done, then that's just a gaping hole of an area for sellers to get into trouble.
You know, it's kind of like everything else. You kind of get what you pay for. And when you're looking for a shortcut, you're looking for, you know, if you want to try to buy, you know, a MacBook Air on Craigslist for $50, you might be able to find it, but it's probably not going to work past that first day. So, you know,
or it has questionable provenance.
Yes.
No idea where that thing came from.
Exactly. You guys have worked with these factories, different factories. So you have factories that you can recommend to people. You know how to make sure the quality of the product stays consistent, which I know is something that a lot of people struggle with. And you have also really helped people through a lot of the common pitfalls, like, you know, things like logistics and tariffs and, you know, all the things that, you know, we see on these private label boards that people are like, wow, I was completely caught off guard by that $5,000 fee. I wish I had spent more money and time doing the research ahead of time because now I'm in the hole.
Yep. And I'm glad you mentioned HTS codes, because that's an area we also see a lot of sellers not paying attention, not just product compliance, but trade compliance. So product compliance, by product compliance, I mean, what are you doing to make sure that product itself is legal to sell or is compliant or safe? Those are things like making sure that it's tested for lead, or making sure that if it's 100% cotton on the label, that it actually is 100% cotton, making sure that it has a label. Those are also required. And then that's product compliance. And then trade compliance is making sure that the shipment itself is compliant. So you have something that's either flying by air. Most of the time you have more issues when you're going by ocean freight because those actually get examined by customs. Not everything gets an in-depth examination, but you do have to file. So making sure that you have the correct HTS code and don't give the wrong one, because even if you're paying more duties, if it's the wrong HTS code, you could still get an examination. So the important thing is to make sure that you're doing it correctly and paying the right amount of duty for the product that you're bringing in. What I see a lot of people make mistakes with is they're not checking the HTS code up front and don't realize that the product that they're bringing in, the amount of duty that they have to pay on it just completely ruined all of their profit on Amazon. So bringing it in from China, say, where some textile items are more expensive, was just not the right way to go. In that case, then it would have made more sense to order the item from Cambodia or from India, because then the product cost is so low that you can include the duty rate and still make a profit. So knowing all those pieces up front makes it possible then to make the right decision about where to source, which factory you're going to source from, not just which factory in China, but is China even the right country? There's a lot of things that actually have been priced out of China now, where you need to go to Southeast Asia or the Indian subcontinent or even Indonesia, where they're a better price and you can get just as good of quality in certain items. The other items, not so much. But in China, China isn't the land of the cheap anymore. China is actually kind of middle of the road for a lot of products now. And in fact, there's some items you can actually get cheaper from North Carolina than you can get from China. So it's important to do the research, to actually do the costing. Look at how much it will cost at customs. Do you know if you need a continuous bond or if you need a single entry bond? What are the different pieces that go into getting this thing from one part of the globe to another? And if you don't know that, and you're not willing to put in a bunch of time for the research for that, then either you shouldn't do it, or you should hire someone who can help you, because there's the school of hard knocks is rather expensive in this area.
Just to back up, HTS would be regarding tariff schedules. So you guys were kind of glazing over with that. So there's certain things that are, there's a lot of regulations that are involved. And so when I see people, I can't speak for other people, but when I see people be like, oh, just get everything from Alibaba, it'll be fine. There can be a lot of things that you're not taking into consideration. I love the, just to kind of give an example of some of the things that you might not think about in regulation. Could you share the example about the children's pajamas that you shared at SCO?
Yes. So one of the things I heard recently was someone who said that they really thought that a great product would be a loose-fitting cotton night set. So the problem is, in the marketplace, there's only these polyester-type items or really scratchy fabric, or really, really tight cotton pajamas. And there's really this whole wide open market for potential loose fitting cotton pajamas. Like, the most comfortable thing you can wear as an adult is cotton flannel loose pajamas, right? So why can't we have this for kids? Well, the problem is that those are illegal. So the method for making sure that children's pajamas are legal to sell is actually the compliance process itself. So the fabrics have to pass for flammability testing, and it's the most stringent flammability testing that exists in the U.S. Then the actual prototypes have to pass on a per prototype basis, so you can't do more than a certain number of units before testing. And then in actual production, you have to test it again, and then you've got to keep all of the burned pieces of cloth with all of their record-keeping information in a filing cabinet somewhere for like the next 10 years. So the recall procedure for children's pajamas that are not compliant is basically, show me your burnt pieces of cloth. And if you can't show them the burnt pieces of cloth to prove compliance, then your item gets recalled. That simple, that easy, it's gone. And it's not just pajamas. You can't get around it by calling it loungewear. If it's something that reasonably could be seen as pajamas, it's advertised as pajamas, or in some ways marketed for the purpose of sleeping, then they'll treat it as pajamas because that's just how it works. So something like this, where you may see this great opening in the marketplace, probably someone has seen it before you and there's a reason that it's not permitted. My other favorite example of this, just in terms of predicting for safety and working with someone who understands what it means to launch a new product, is a product that was actually out quite a long time ago in the 90s, and it was for fisher people, anyone who's going out fishing, to get worms in the morning. And what you'd do is you'd go out to like a puddle in your yard and you'd zap the puddle, and then all of the worms would be electrocuted and float to the surface. And I can't imagine what could be the possible problem with standing next to a puddle and then zapping it with live electricity. But from from the research that we did on this particular product as an example of stupid things people think are great, there were over 40 people who got electrocuted before this product was recalled. And things like that happen on a regular basis where entrepreneurs are just thinking about opening these in the marketplace and trying to sell things, and they're not thinking about compliance.
It's like the lawn darts of fishing.
You know, and you know, some of them seem like really obvious, and then some of them you're like, oh, well, that, you know, and then there's also other requirements. So if you say, you know, I'm going to create this private label product, and I also want to send it to, you know, Canada, and or I also want to send it to the UK, then that adds a whole other layer of complexity on there. And so, you know, I personally feel like there's times to pay for an expert. You know, like when my child needs surgery, I'm not price checking. When I'm looking at something especially if you're going to be buying a product that could have a safety implication, like a child getting hurt, or, you know, somebody getting sick, or somebody's house burning down because the hoverboard was made incorrect, this is not the time to penny pinch. You know, I think getting the word out about your service is really, really important, because I think there's a lot of misinformation about the dangers of the compliance and the safety, but also about the potential patent infringement for some of the products that people are doing. And you were saying that even a garlic press has some things that it needs to go through, right?
Yep. So I know that garlic press is the number one example of what people want to do on Amazon is like, oh yeah, I'm going to start my own company and I'm going to make a garlic press. And the problem is, of course, that garlic is something that you put in your food and then you put it in your mouth and then you swallow it. So imagine that this garlic press is something that you've bought from super cheapo factory in South China, and they haven't done any testing on what they're coloring that plastic with or whether it's actually food grade stainless steel. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's got nickel in it. And now you're actually poisoning yourself with this garlic press, or even worse, poisoning your customers, because garlic has juices that come out. It's got oils, and those will react with the product that they're being pressed into. And now that has transferred into the food itself and will be ingested. So it doesn't take that much of certain kinds of toxins to harm children. It takes a lot more to harm adults. But there's a reason why anything that touches food, called food contact substances, sometimes also called indirect food additives, because they're not intentionally added to food, but by putting them on or next to food or using them to carry food, they are indirectly added to the food. Those items are regulated by the FDA. So with something like a garlic press, I would expect it to be food grade stainless steel, or I would expect it to be a plastic that's been tested for phthalates, that's been tested for heavy metals, to make sure that the product is not toxic for humans.
So I'm just going to say what a lot of people might be thinking. And, well, it seems like a lot of people are doing this and it's fine, so it must be fine, right?
Well, just because you can get away with it doesn't mean that it's a good idea. One of the things that was interesting change a few years ago was in the jewelry department. In fine jewelry, there was a lot of stuff that was not necessarily gold, more like gold tone or a very thin gold coating over something else, a base metal, and they were being called like 14 karat gold, or things were cubic zirconia and they were being passed off as actual diamonds, or any number of other things where people weren't being told that it was a lab created sapphire versus an actual natural sapphire. Sometimes you can tell by the price, but if someone was selling a lab created sapphire at a proper sapphire price, then why would the customer even know to question this? Well, there was enough, let's say, complaining from the vendors who were in fine jewelry about the lack of trust in the Amazon marketplace. There was complaining as well. As Kelly will probably say later, one of the things you can do as a seller is report on another seller who's not being compliant. And if you know that another seller is not being compliant, you complain. Well, there were enough of these complaints that they decided to do an audit. And they didn't tell the sellers they were doing the audit. They just did it. And any sellers who failed were then notified that they were no longer allowed to sell in fine jewelry. They were never told this. The requirements have always been part of the FTC requirements. How you label jewelry is part of the Federal Trade Commission requirements. Anyone can go find it. People were not compliant with it, and they just got shut down and kicked out of the whole category. This continues to happen to this day. Most sellers are being audited on a 2 to 3 times a year basis. And if you pass, great, you get to stay. If you fail, you get kicked out. And it's a 2 to 3 month process to reapply, if they even let you reapply. If it was a really egregious situation, they may not even let you reapply. They may ban you for life. So just because it's possible to do it for now doesn't mean that Amazon isn't working on something to boot sellers out. I have a situation with food safety right now where a product was complained about by a customer and the chill chain process wasn't followed. So basically something where the chill chain process is followed should be arriving at the customer's house and used with the correct temperature. So if that's a cold item, then it needs to be arriving at less than 42 degrees Fahrenheit, for example. And Amazon found out about this. And so, of course, they investigated and they shut down the seller's products until they could get the information they were looking for. So it's important that just because you've been able to do it so far doesn't mean that you actually are supposed to be doing it that way. It just means you've been lucky. And it's not just Amazon that you have to worry about. Another seller that we've spoken to brought in a junior size product. Anything for someone 13 and under is considered for children in the U.S. This junior size product had a handle that had adhesive on it that wasn't compliant, and it was meant to be held by children who were exercising. So you can imagine it's a sweaty grip on a handle that had toxic material on it. So the customs officials seized the goods, they had them tested, and then CPSC ordered the entire container to be destroyed. So not to say that it's going to happen to you, just that this is the risk that you're taking by not making sure that it's compliant. And certainly you may be able to get your container in just fine, but that doesn't mean that it's in any way guaranteed.
So, you know, not only are you risking the safety of other people, you know, which should be an impetus enough where you should say, okay, well, I need to get an expert. If I'm going to do this, I want to do it right. I'm going to, you know, do my due diligence. But even if that's not enough, you know, because we've seen that Amazon has done that in the jewelry, and I would imagine if they started it, they would not hesitate to do that in other categories as well. And you make an agreement to follow, you know, all the laws to make sure that to do your due diligence. They expect you to do a deep dive before you list anything. So if you're not doing that, then they're completely within their rights to destroy everything, right?
Yeah, exactly. And there's also that perception too, just to piggyback a little bit on what Rachel said, that when people are looking to enter a marketplace, regardless of whether you're talking about garlic presses or children's products, I think sometimes people who are new, they have a concept of compliance. They have a concept that there are regulations that they need to be aware of, but they see what others are doing and they assume that those other sellers are doing those things. And so they just kind of pattern based off on superficial data that's visible to them in front without asking those questions, without doing those deep dives. And I think that kind of immediacy of e-commerce feeds that perception, which is exactly why you should put the brakes on and say, is what I'm doing potentially going to be harmful to my customers as well as my own business? So that little bit of self-reflection in a way.
Yeah, because somebody was asking me about, you know, well, you know, this person is saying I should do this, but I see that it says not to do that in the terms of service. Can I still do it? And I said,
no.
And they're like, but they're a big seller and they said it was fine and they've been doing it. Amazon would have noticed. And I'm like, that's not the case, right?
No. I get that question a lot. It's remarkable how often it comes up, and it's an amazing dialogue to have because you will often see some very wide eyes and some sweat begin to appear upon brows because they realize they have miscalculated gravely and now they have a problem. And to saying what you were saying, Robin, about how Amazon makes the rules and they have a right to change the platform, I always advise sellers to know the space that they're selling in, because a lot of folks are specialized. Each one of those categories comes with a vagary to it that if you're not aware of what can happen, you can get burnt very quickly. The landscape in retail has changed, and the landscape in e-commerce is still evolving. And so I think some of these things that are very common at the brick and mortar level are a lot harder to grasp for people at e-commerce, but you have to know. What you don't know can destroy you.
And that's why it's so important to make sure that you're always in compliance of all the laws, of all the Amazon terms of service, and ignorance is not an excuse. And that's why, especially if you are jumping straight into private label, which I never really recommend that people go straight into private label. I mean, you guys are experts. What level would you say of a seller would you recommend
before they start to go into a private label?
I don't know if it's necessarily level of seller, but level of image. So we have kind of two ideal clients. The first ideal client is actually someone who's been successful offline in some way. They have a successful business and they want to expand on Amazon. So they know how things work. They've probably talked to an accountant. They probably talked to a CPA. However, they want to arrange that. They probably talked to their lawyer about setting things up. They know that there are rules and laws and things that you follow. Okay. So then they've already started from that level. Then you can work with them to do something on Amazon. And it's not so much that you can't start directly with doing your own brand. It's just a little bit harder of a learning curve. The other kind of ideal client that we have is someone who's doing really well in wholesale and who's been making money, doing a good job buying things that exist in the marketplace and reselling them. Those people know how Amazon works. They know the difficulty with Amazon, but they may not really know the situation with branding or with the risks that you're taking on by doing your own brand. So those are the two where we think that we have the most to offer, because either they don't know Amazon or they don't know branding. And those two together are pretty complicated. So if you don't know one or the other, if you're just starting and you don't know anything about business and you don't know anything about branding, and then you're just going to go directly to branded products on Amazon, no, I would not recommend that. That's a good way to very much overwhelm yourself.
So, you know, that, and I agree, because I think what you said is right too. Like, you know, if somebody has experience offline, if they've already done things, they're just moving into an e-commerce space, but, you know, then they understand what kind of insurance, liability-wise, they have the right business entities. You guys also offer a lot of other things. Kelly, can you talk a little bit about, you know, really where your specialty lies?
Sure. I spent almost 9.5 years with Amazon, and most of that was in the seller performance space. And I know those two words in the same sentence evoke terrible fear.
Dun, dun, dun.
Exactly. The Law and Order theme should play. You know, I get it. I get the fear, but that's where I spent the majority of my time. And I spent a little bit of time in product compliance. And so that's why I also have some expertise that overlaps with Rachel's, although I defer to her excellent memory and amazing knowledge of regulations and details and minutiae there, because I cannot compete. But that's why we work well together. So
lots of details.
very many details. But my primary really experience within seller performance kind of evolved along two very important parts of the equation. Seller performance is responsible for an enormous amount of stuff on that platform. They have to guard against bad actors who are trying to fraudulently get onto the site with stolen credentials and fleece buyers and sellers alike on the site. And they're also responsible for kind of maintaining order amongst the legitimate sellers who are trying to do the right thing, who are selling legitimate goods and are trying to be successful sellers on the site. So those are two very simple dichotomies, but they involve a lot of different moving parts. And so my expertise in policy and how that is applied to sellers is really where it's at. So I can tell you quite a bit from a historical perspective, because I watched the team grow from 2 offices and about 10 investigators to about 7 offices and about 400 investigators.
Wow.
Over that time. Yeah. Can you say, wow, that was a leap forward? It was. It was massive. It was great for the platform, but there were a lot of bumps in the roads for sellers. So thus the fear. And again, I think that kind of comes by it honestly. When you grow that fast, it can be very hard to appropriately, you know, engage with your customer base, if you will, and seller performance has a lot to protect. So that's kind of where I've been at. But I'm happy to talk about whatever anybody wants to know about how to deal with seller performance, because I think that's the main question I get in any capacities. How do I handle seller performance? I always say that seller performance wants 3 things: accountability, and they want reactive corrections and proactive corrections, regardless of whether we're talking about your account privileges or just loss of an ASIN. If you can provide those 3 things in your responses, you are going to get much further along with your designated goal, whether it's to get your account back or to get your ASIN back, than if you do what most people do, which is have a nervous breakdown and throw a bunch of words onto an email screen and then hit send and go.
Lots and lots of words.
Yes, lots and lots of words. Here, just blah. And that doesn't help. That is probably the surest way to get stuck in what I call the never-ending response loop. Because if you start out on the wrong foot, it's extraordinarily difficult to get onto the right one, because really you want your account back, or you want your ASIN back, or you want to understand why you've been sanctioned in some way. That's not going to happen if you just explode onto the screen and expect a coherent response.
And no excuses either, right? Like, no, like, my dog died, and then my dog's right. cat died, and then it was horrible, yeah. and that's why all my things were lead paint. You know, yes. like,
Yeah, the accountability aspect is huge. I mean, and I've told sellers that I've spoken to a lot of folks face-to-face since I started doing this work, and one of the things I hear a lot is like, you know, I had some things happen, and here's how it affected me. And it's totally legitimate and understandable to say, I was hospitalized for 6 weeks because I had heart surgery. And that's fine. Tell them that if that's what you need to tell them, you know, whatever has happened to you, but don't expect it to be, I don't know what the right phrasing for this is, but don't expect it to be like an episode on Lifetime where suddenly the violins come into play and the birds sing and they go, really, we need to give this person another chance. It doesn't work like that. It's not in the movies where suddenly everyone has a revelation that this seller must be restored to the platform. It doesn't work that like that. But be honest. If something happened to you that drastically impacted you, say it. But don't make excuses, and certainly don't lie. Lying is bad.
If you are in the position of needing to go to get some sort of surgery or go on mm-hmm. some sort of trip, then Amazon has made that possible for you to do by setting your yes. product on your account on vacation. So right. there's not a ton of sympathy. I mean, Amazon's not running a nonprofit. So if you don't know what to do, then ask someone who does. And right. and in some cases, if you start getting conflicting information from the groups you're in or whatever, that's the point at which to ask an expert, because there's a lot of low-hanging fruit out there that other people have dealt with who can give you feedback. But there's a lot of other stuff where we see a ton of misinformation in the Facebook groups. So right. be careful with those. If you start getting weird, conflicting responses, it means they're guessing. And ask somebody who knows what they're talking about.
Right. And to Rachel's point, too, that vacation feature exists for not just fun times, but because when something happens, you might be able to need to flip that switch. Understanding, of course, that you can't do that if you've just had both of your legs broken in a car accident. But I hope that there's someone that can do it for you. Regardless, accountability, accountability, accountability. I cannot stress that enough, because you will see people who try anything and everything to get back on the platform except the truth. And trust me when I say that people that do risk mitigation work, which is really what seller performance does, they can see through that pretty clearly. And it's just not the way to go. And honestly, do you want your relationship to be based on a lie? Ask yourself that in real life. It applies to your seller account. It will come back to haunt you. It always does.
So, you know, so what I'm hearing is, instead of being like, well, I was in heart surgery and then, mm-hmm. like it should be, I was in heart surgery. I failed to make sure that I had a contingency plan. That will never happen again. Here's the steps that I made sure that if I get struck by a bus, that these are the things going forward. So it's not an yes. excuse. It's saying, I acknowledge I failed, and here's the steps to correct it.
Exactly, exactly. Because Amazon, though it, as Rachel often says, truly does not care. The people who are making these decisions, they are human beings and they do understand. But the key is always combining that accountability, reactive correction, and proactive correction. Because really, you only do one of those things or two of those things, it's not going to be enough. And how you phrased it is exactly perfect. That's the kind of appeal that I would look at when I was an investigator and say, this person understands. They have, you know, exactly what it takes from a mental standpoint, a mental toughness standpoint, to say, I made this mistake in the face of this great tragedy, and now I'm going to move forward. Yeah, that's perfect. I couldn't have said it better. Sure you want my job?
No, thank you. I've heard I've heard Amazon is not the place to feel good about yourself.
true, but you walk out with many things. Rachel probably can attest to this. You walk out with great relationships, lots of knowledge, and an immense respect for time off and leisure. Yeah. Gotta have that break.
So I think a lot of the fear from stellar performance is because it feels like magic, kind of like like an old mythological like guy in a cloud that's going to smite thee like down. Yes. And it's really stellar performance is there to protect you, because if the brand loses credibility, we all lose sales. So stellar performance is really our friend.
Yeah. It's hard to see that, but that's a great analogy as well, because what I always try to explain to people when I trained investigators, which was a large part of my job, I always said to the folks I worked with, you must remember two things. One is that there is a person on the other end of that screen whose business you are affecting. And two, when someone reports to you, as Rachel mentioned earlier in the podcast, when they bring a complaint to you and you know that this is a seller talking to about another seller, that person is doing the platform a favor. They care about the community. They want things to be done right. That is important. Do not discount that as petty squabbling between two sellers, which of course it can be, because people get upset. They feel like they're losing market share. They want to strike out. But most of the time, those complaints are very, very solid and they're legit and they should be acted upon. And so, yes, seller performance is there to help make sure that platform is safe for you as a seller. Because if people are doing bad things, if they're bad actors in your category and they're dragging down your sales, what good are we? You know, that's what I would say about seller performance. So yes, they very much do a lot of hidden work that's not appreciated to make that platform safe for other sellers. They protect other sellers from being phished so that they don't lose control of their account, which can be devastating and horrendously damaging. They protect you from bad actors who come onto the site with no real goods, who are trying to just basically get a whole bunch of money and run, and that affects your sales. All of that's unseen, but it's extremely important and very vital to the health of the seller platform.
And, you know, to the degree that Amazon doesn't care, you know, and I mean, to a degree, like, they don't care about your sad story. They don't care about your excuses. But, you know, to that degree, also, there's another side of Amazon where they very much care about the customer. They very much care about the customer experience. It's not that Amazon's out to get you. They don't care enough to even want to get you. They're just doing their job. And, you know, we have to remember that people who are in seller performance are people.
Yes. Yes, they are. And I actually think that's a great way of saying it, is that the investigators I worked with were immensely talented people who cared very much about making sure that the platform is as fair and trusted a place to transact as you can have. Whether that means you're not having problems with buyers who are trying to get something for nothing, or you're not having problems with another seller impacting you, or you're not having problems with somebody trying to fish you and get your credentials. They cared about making sure those things didn't happen. And the whole goal for them really is to make Amazon the most trusted third-party seller platform to transact on. If they're not doing that, then, you know, it's a big loss for everybody. So what they do is very important, but that fear is understandable because, as you said, it's like the wizard behind the curtain. What are they doing? How can they see that? We don't know. Well, yeah, and that's by design. They have to protect what they do. They can't reveal the cards, or that gives people ways around things, and that's not ideal either. But they do what they do in a relative silence, and they toil away kind of in the dark, but they're not automatons, they're not automated, and they really are people, and they're very smart people.
As working in seller performance, like, what advice do you have? I mean, obviously watching your return rates, making sure you're answering your customer service emails, but what, you know, what are some of the other things that you would say, like, these are the things that are a high priority or that we're seeing look like a high priority at Amazon?
You know, that's a great question that I think varies slightly by category. One thing I always recommended to sellers when I would have conversations with them outside of my role in seller performance, because occasionally I would meet with sellers in other capacities, would be to say, if you're selling in, let's say, what's a good category with some oddities, like the gemstones, loose gemstones, not jewelry per se, but just people who sell crystals and gemstones and things like that. You have some oddities that occur in your category that are different than someone who's selling in electronics. You need to know what the rules are specific to you, and you need to watch those rules because they change. You can't obviously predict what Amazon's going to do in reaction to, say, regulatory pressure from the FDA or a lawsuit that happens over a product recall. But knowing what the oddities are for your particular product type and how that is impacted by e-commerce is important. If you're not sure what those things are, ask an expert. Don't guess. Don't rely on Facebook. Don't go to Twitter. Find someone who can tell you, hey, this is something you need to pay attention to for your particular product space. The other thing that I think really is often lost is how the buyer experience can be so wrong from the buyer's perspective. Sellers will talk to me a lot and think, hey, I'm doing a great job. I've done this, I've done this, I've done this. And if you kind of look at their metrics from a distance, they look pretty good until you start really getting into the deep and you're looking at not just the return rate, but you're looking at these new beta metrics everybody's worried about. And you look at their buyer-seller messages and you can see that they're not taking care of the customer. Put yourself in Amazon's shoes and ask, how would Amazon resolve this problem? If more sellers would do that, they would hear a lot less from seller performance about abusive language towards buyers, about not handling their returns correctly, about rejecting returns incorrectly, and all those kinds of things that kind of bring up enforcement actions. And then there's the item quality side, to get away from behavior per se. Make sure that you're sourcing quality, authentic goods. I can't stress that enough. It is so easy to get a hold of counterfeit goods because you're trying to bust into the market, kind of like the person who wants to do private label so badly that they know nothing about regulations or flammability or lead testing or whatever they need to know. Those things can kill your business before it ever gets started. Know the provenance of your item. Know where you're getting them from. Have a trusted relationship. Do the homework and vet people that you buy from before you invest your life savings and, again, potentially tank your business before it has a chance to get started. Then you won't see seller performance knocking on that proverbial email door going, hello, it's us to take your seller privileges away.
And when she's saying talk to your buyer, to people you're buying, that also means if you're doing retail arbitrage, you need to know if a company buys seconds, if they're buying liquidations. You know, just because somebody has a booth at ASD doesn't mean their products are authentic.
Right. I'm glad you brought up retail arbitrage. Rachel and I have talked about this quite a bit because we do we brain trust on a lot of different issues that we see with sellers. And one thing that we commonly encounter is people who don't know that about retail arbitrage. They don't know the difference between seconds, thirds, liquidation with people who have contracts with insurance carriers when a store has a flood and a third of the products are bad, but the other two thirds are great. They don't know anything about that. Retail arbitrage is a way to get started. I don't necessarily think of it as a great long-term strategy. And Rachel, tell me if you think I'm off base here, but I do feel like the way that Amazon is moving in terms of product quality issues, which again brings up seller performance, they really are kind of becoming more tight about these guidelines, and people who are doing retail arbitrage are at great risk for having ASINs removed and listings shut down and accounts canceled because of condition issues that relate to doing retail arbitrage.
You know, I don't even know if it's Amazon that retail arbitrage sellers should be as worried about. This is coming to the attention of the brand owners themselves.
True.
So there's been a lot of activity by the brand owners to try to take down sellers who are making crappy detail pages or are selling products that are discontinued. The very worst situations for brand owners, the kind that just make them all want to curl up in a little ball and start crying in the corner, are retail arbitrage sellers who buy in the US and sell in the UK. Those products are illegal to sell in the UK in most cases. And these small-time sellers are basically violating the law and selling this person's product in the UK, which can open them up to a huge host of liability issues. Mm-hmm. So a lot of brand owners, we're starting to see brand owners reach out to people in the industry, sometimes to us, sometimes to other people, and say, how can I open my own selling account? How can I sell my discontinued inventory? How can I get brand registered? How can I kick these sellers who are ruining my brand off of my products? Mm-hmm. And it's something that, you know, it's really important for folks who are in the wholesale industry. Perhaps this is a way that you can grow your business by partnering with some of these brand owners who are really upset about sellers who aren't being conscious of the brand that they're basically running through the mud.
You know, I'm definitely seeing that. You know, as somebody who buys wholesale, I went, you know, from a couple of years ago, I would go to ASD and a lot of booths would treat me like a pariah. And now all of a sudden, now part of it is, you know, I have a little bit more clout in the community, but, you know, now, you know, when people realize you're an expert in Amazon, now they're very interested. Now I provide a value that nobody else does. So, you know, there has been a shift, and there will continue continue to be shifts. And so it's important as sellers, we kind of get our noses out of our navel and like really be watching the, you know, the playing field to see how things are going to play out.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great assessment of that. And it's a tough way to go, I think, but I think retail arbitrage still is viable for a lot of people. But Rachel's right. The brand owners are really kind of like, they've had it. They're drawing that line in the sand. And I think we'll see more of that in as 2016 progresses as well.
And the other thing that I see that's a really common thing is, you know, new sellers wanting to get ungated in everything. Where, you know, tell me what your opinion is. I personally feel like you should master the open categories and then only go in, only get ungated in categories that you've taken the time to really do the research to know the rules for that category.
The
reason why is because they're hard. I mean, they're and in some cases they're gated because they're heavily regulated and cause problems. Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons why grocery is gated and why HPC is gated is because there's so much counterfeit that's not just counterfeit because it harms the brand, but because it harms you. Like people mm-hmm. are not thinking about the fact that these things are unregulated cosmetics that you're absorbing into your body, into your skin, and that's okay. Like I see returns comments all the time about people saying, oh, I use this product and I think it's fake because it caused my entire face to break out in red welts. Like, that's awful. So yeah, stay out of those categories. We don't know what you're buying. You don't know where it's coming from. You're hurting people potentially by not doing that research.
Mm-hmm. And even when you take away the elements of those categories that do have very direct product safety concerns, if you don't know anything about selling high-end electronics, don't jump into that feet first, not that it's gated per se, but just using that as an example. Don't jump feet first into something like that where you're out of your knowledge desk, because I guarantee you something will come up that will bite you and it will cause you many, many problems. I see a lot of folks try that approach. It's kind of a scattershot approach, because if I throw this much spaghetti on the wall, how much will stick? That's not how you form a solid business.
Yeah, what we teach is to embrace your inner weird, to find that weird in yourself or to borrow some weird from a friend, because that you're already Amazon's, if you're already Amazon's customer for cloth diapers or you're already Amazon's customer for pretty barf bags, then you know what people are looking for, and then you can start rather than just trying to throw mud against the wall and hope it'll stick.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember the name of the book, but there's a fantastic very short read out there about the history of branding and how some amazing companies that started with their brand eventually tanked it because they tried to be too many things to too many people. To me, that analogy works for a seller. I happen to know art supplies really well. So that would be an area I would focus on and not try to dive into stereo equipment because, or TVs, because I wish I didn't even own a TV. That's how much I love them. I know nothing about them. It would be silly for me to try to work into that space. It's just not something I know. And I think a lot of folks don't think about that. They don't think I have an area of expertise. We're all consumers, and we're all consumers of certain things, some more than others. Use that knowledge to your advantage and don't try to be something you're not yet.
Yeah, because just because, you know, something is the new cool thing to be selling, you know, for, you know, a couple months ago it was oversized bras, now it's shoes, yep. You know. I almost think it's better to go the opposite direction. If everybody's selling oversized bras, I want to go the other direction.
Right. My favorite example of people trying to jump on a bandwagon and having zero idea of what they were doing was, this would probably have been 2005 or 6, the Tickle Me Elmos, when those came out. Oh, man. Ugly. People who were not normally toy sellers, who sold in completely different, you know, categories like industrial and scientific, they saw what the hot thing was and they tried to go out and get them, and it caused mass chaos and pandemonium on the website. I have never seen so many bad buyer experiences in the course of a holiday season as I did during that time. I worked on the holiday gating every year for toys, which, as you probably are aware, happens every fall. They start telling you whether or not you're going to be allowed to sell. It's a very massive project to ensure that buyer experiences are good and that sellers who are knowledgeable in that area can sell their product and fulfill and have a great holiday experience as well. Yeah, that was painful. That's a great example of not jumping on the bandwagon.
You know, and that happens every year. Everyone's like, well, I'm going to sell toys. Like, I've been selling these pencils all year round, but now I'm going to sell toys because I have done no research and I have no idea what the sell-through rate is. And inevitably in January, they're like, wow, that was a really horrible idea.
Yes. Well, and the other thing too is that I think you take the human element part of that and think, Do I want to be responsible for the young single mother in Georgia whose child did not get hot toy, whatever it is, for this year because I failed as a seller? Do I want the emails where they tell me how the child cried for 3 weeks straight? I don't. I don't want those emails. Don't do it. If you're not ready to sell on toys, I don't care if you've been ungated to do it. Don't do it. You are asking to cause yourself problems. The expectations are exponentially higher for buyers in that category during the holiday season. You have to be ready.
And so, you know, with Cascadia, are you guys doing a lot of appeals for people? Are you helping people kind of prevent those appeals? What are some of the things that you offer in that area?
Actually, both of those things. I spend my days doing a mixture of what I think of as the proactive and preventative maintenance, the advice that I'm trying to provide to clients who could potentially have some issues. I spend the other portion of my time writing appeals based on the information that they've given me about what's happened to their account. And it's all over the map. I work with clients in every possible product segment who have had many, many years of experience on the site. Some have had very few weeks or months. And it's a process of getting to a place where they understand what needs to be done, taking that narrative, taking that information and making it usable for them. Because writing an appeal is not, as much as it's kind of common sense to me, I have bias because I've spent time in the system, so to speak. But for sellers, it's not. It's hard. Seller performance does not make it easy. And there's a reason for that, going back to having to protect the proprietary processes. If they tell you exactly what they want you to do, you're just going to parrot it. And sometimes people don't think about that. And they'll say, well, I don't understand what it is that they want. And I'm like, well, they're looking for accountability. They're looking for corrections and proactive fixes so this doesn't happen again. And you get that light bulb moment. They go, oh. So we provide services around ASIN reinstatement, account reinstatement, helping to interpret policy warnings that aren't necessarily ASIN or account sanctions. Sometimes people get warnings about things that they don't really understand. They've done some kind of behavioral violation and they're like, well, what did I do wrong? And so I help explain to the customer what they've done and how to not do that again. And sometimes I work with their customer service personnel. If there's an issue with maybe their clients or their buyers are getting really snarky customer service emails, I can help them say, hey, this is a violation. Don't do this. And then Emily will go in and say, hey, let me write content for you so that you don't have to handwrite everything and feel stressed. You have a ready-made piece of amazing content tailored to you that goes straight to your buyers that will solve these problems. So it's a lot of, I guess the word is kind of talking with the client, finding out where their problems are, looking at the account from their perspective and helping them identify risk points and then tailoring solutions for those risk points, whether it's content, just advice, meeting with their employees, or writing a plan of action for whatever problem that they've got.
So, you know, if people are getting a policy violation, policy warning, and they don't understand what it is, they can come to you to help figure out what that is. And they should. If you don't understand what that warning, you don't understand, you can't just ignore it. You need to,
right.
You need that was your only warning, most likely. And you were lucky to get that.
Right. And because Amazon is not, their terms of service are written in such a way that they are not beholden to tell you much of anything. And the fact that they do, take that as an opportunity to work with it and improve, no matter what the warning is. Even if you get a warning that just makes you want to throw things at the wall, I don't sell counterfeit, how dare you? Yeah, I know, I hear that a lot. And some sellers, they accidentally did source, you know, counterfeit material. It happens. It happens to good, legitimate people trying to do the right thing. It also happens to people who are not so aware and they just source what's the cheapest stuff and away they go. Whatever the warning is, don't ignore it. Ignoring does not make it go away. It's always a permanent record anyway. As soon as they send that message, it's part of your account. It's there for life, for as long as you sell. So responding to it in a respectful way that, again, addresses accountability and talks about the corrections and proactive actions you can take to stop future recurrences, that's the way to go. I know it seems kind of simple, but it can be difficult depending on the scenario that you run across. So yes, when you ask the experts to help you interpret it, don't rely on Facebook or Twitter. You will get conflicting information. If you're not sure, talk to a seller that you have a mentorship relationship with. That can be one of the most valuable things that you can do. If you are a seller without a mentor, get one.
Yeah, and that's, you know, if people are always saying, should I go to a conference? If you go to a conference just to find a mentor, then that's worth it.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And to that point about counterfeit, sometimes people believe that Amazon believes that they're selling counterfeit, and that's not actually what it means. So when you're looking at product quality, which is the area that I try to focus on, which is much easier to control when you're your own brand, you can really control it at the factory level. When you're just selling somebody else's stuff, it's a little bit harder. But a lot of times what they're actually referring to is that the customer had a complaint about authenticity, not that they actually think it's counterfeit. If they actually think it's counterfeit, then your approach has to be a lot different. You have to take immediate and aggressive action to fire the supplier, to remove all the inventory, to give them a certificate of destruction. Like there is no way that you can go too overboard in showing how seriously you take counterfeit. Actually not counterfeit, and it was just the customer who thought it was counterfeit, then your solution has to be a lot different, because that's basically a customer perception issue. Your question is, why did the customer think it was counterfeit? And especially for people who are doing their own branded goods, almost always it's because of crappy packaging. Almost every single time, people will buy whatever it is that the Chinese manufacturer gives them. And it could be a cheap poly bag. It could be really thin paperboard boxes, but it looks cheap. It looks made in China. You want to spend the money on proper packaging, to where you're not shipping something to someone in a piece of plastic bag that looks like garbage. Of course, they're going to think that it's something that's a knockoff. Even if they don't understand that it's your brand, they're going to think that it's a fake something. So you have to manage that customer experience in a proactive way to say, no, I'm sending them a package that looks like something they'd buy at the store, or at least close enough that they feel that they can trust it.
And not to jump too far off, but one of the things that I see coming up over and over again is people sourcing shoes and the lids are torn off, and so they're just putting them in poly bags. From a seller performance perspective, what are your thoughts on that?
I think Rachel just covered it with the, you know, the packaging makes all the difference in the world. And sourcing shoes is not something I've spent a lot of time on, I'll be absolutely honest. Shoes and apparel are not necessarily my areas of expertise. But I mean, there's got to be a better way to package that. And Rachel's right. Put yourself in the eyes as a buyer and look at that experience and thought, okay, I ordered these Nike shoes and I get them in a poly bag? What is this? There's got to be a better way to do that. From a seller performance standpoint, you're going to become very open to complaints, not only about authenticity, I think, but condition. If I am buying what I expect to be brand new shoes, my Keens better come in a box that say Keen. If they don't, I'm going to wonder where you found them and what dumpster they were behind. So yeah, you're opening yourself up to problems. And packaging is key. And I don't mean to make fun in a way, but I also want people to realize you don't have to be all serious about this all the time. Seller performance is scary, I'm not going to lie, because they have the ability to shut you down. But let's demystify the, you know, incredible, fearful monolith that it is. They're trying to protect the marketplace. If you put yourself in the shoes of the consumer and then kind of think about it from, if I was seller performance standpoint and I saw this, what would I think? Prevent a lot of problems, because then you're thinking less one-dimensionally, more three-dimensionally about how does this transaction that I put out into the world affect the platform, not just from the buyer, but from seller performance standpoint. I don't recommend putting things out there where you are going to have packaging that's going to be suspect. Some categories have very specific rules about how you can market or offer items if the packaging is damaged. Some categories are a little more restrictive than others. And I would imagine that in apparel, that's a huge no-no.
And, you know, people will be like, but that's the only way. And it's just, there's so much opportunity out there. Like, if you have an opportunity that, yes, it could get you, you know, really, you know, 7 months of, you know, $5,000 a month profit. But if you really want to make this a long-term business, is that a risk you want to take? And that's kind of where.
The risk tolerance thing is something I don't think people ask themselves enough. I am a fairly risk-averse person in the sense that I'm pretty aware of what my boundaries are and what I should and shouldn't do. And I'm not a big fan of testing those, because it's kind of like gravity. If I step off this bridge, I know what's going to happen. That is exactly how I feel about jumping into a business where, yes, the short-term gains could be enormous, the long-term consequences could be permanent. I've worked with clients that did not understand that or didn't have a very good concept of it, and they sourced bad product. Unsafe Apple chargers is a big one that comes up repeatedly, and they don't even realize how unsafe these products are. and they have sabotaged their ability to sell on Amazon before they even get started. So yeah, don't do that.
And that would go with whether you're trying to private label, your wholesale, retail arbitrage, thrifting. I don't care what you're doing. Right. You know, you need to be thinking about the long term. So, you know, you guys are amazing. And I've been so impressed with the level of knowledge and the expertise. And obviously, having been on the other side, you guys have a huge advantage over. And you are, what would be a great secret weapon for any business, especially for those sellers who are looking to move into private label or they have a concern about seller performance. And so they can go to your website, thinkcascadia.com or Cascadia Seller Solutions. If you Google it, it comes up too, I believe, right? If you click on core competence, I think that you guys have some amazing products as far as services that you guys are offering. People would almost be silly if you're going to do something to not do it through people who actually have been on the other side and have lived and breathed this for so many years.
Well, we couldn't agree
more. That's true. We couldn't agree more. We love ourselves very much, clearly. No, we are very... Yeah, we do. I'm being somewhat facetious. We have a great team. And I have to say that working with Rachel and Emily is a highlight of my professional experience and really kind of takes all the things I learned at Amazon and brings them into a great, sharp focus. And clients out there, potential clients out there, get the benefit of like 25 years combined experience, I guess, or almost 20 years combined experience between the three of us. And the drive and the will to make your experience as a seller better than what it is today. Because really, it's a Wild West attitude out there sometimes, and you need a little guidance. That's what we do. We're here to help and make things a little less crazy.
Rachel, we kind of talked on the phone a little bit about, you know, if somebody wants a private label and they want to do it right, we think we said between $5,000 and $10,000, including your services and getting the product, unless they want to like source like luxury couches from Greece or something, you know, but in general, you know, for that would be kind of what you're looking for as for a startup cost, correct?
Right. And that would be something that's fairly simple to do. If it's something that requires a mold, like you need to have some thick injection molded, or you need to have a particular kind of design, like a metal design, then that's going to be more expensive because the factory has to make that tool just for you. So if it's something where you can take like the top of one thing and the bottom of another thing and make the product that you want to make, then yeah, it's between $5,000 and $10,000 to really get started to do it properly with, you know, design an insert, have a proper insert in your box, drive people to your own website, make sure you're brand registered, have a proper logo, do good pictures, have lifestyle photos, have, if it's appropriate to the product, have six-sided photos of your image, because it's not just about driving traffic. There's a ton of stuff on there about driving traffic, but how do you convert people to actually buy your stuff? Well, it's by having an excellent detail page with really good stuff. So you want to spend the money where it makes sense. And that isn't just in compliance. I know I've talked a lot about that, but it's also about making it a really great experience for the customer when they go on your detail page to where they're like, yeah, this is the thing I want to buy. And then when they get it and it's in their hands, it functions like they expect. And that's when you ask them for review. So the biggest area that we see people falling down is they do a great job at driving traffic through sponsored ads. They make a really nice detail page. And then they don't verify that the product they're selling is actually the product that's being shipped to the customer. So then the reviews start coming in organically that are, you know, 2 stars, 3 stars, and then everyone's really frustrated. So yeah, so make sure you've got the money up front though. One of the things that is really frustrating to us is when people think that by saving $200 here or there that they're going to somehow still be fine. And obviously we're focused on being frugal. We're helping you launch something that is essentially a low-cost product at the end of the day. But at the same time, if you save a few pennies by cutting out things that are really essential to having a good launch, it's the penny-wise, pound-foolish process. You know, you want to make sure that you spend money on the things that matter.
Well, and you know, sometimes people will come to me and they'll be like, well, I think I want to do a private label. What do you think? And I always say, you know, if you're at the point financially where if that private label fails, you're out of business, you're probably not ready yet. You should always only invest what you're willing to lose. And, but you need to have enough to do it right so that your risk of losing it goes down significantly. So saving $100 on, you know, having the factory on a factory audit is going to hurt you more in the long run. So you want to make sure that you really do have the capital to do it right, and that you're not going to be, if that something happens where something gets caught up in customs, then that's not going to destroy your business by reducing your cash flow for 3 or 4 months.
Yeah, that's great advice on the private label side. And I actually think that applies very much to general seller business. If you are doing wholesale or RA or some combination of that, trust me when I say Amazon is going to know if you are having cash flow problems. Do not try to do something crazy short term to boost yourself. If you're having issues, you've got to figure out where to cut your losses and protect your business for the long term. Don't do insane product buys trying to extend the life of your cash flow. If you've got issues, you need to consult experts like the CPAs and other attorneys that can help with that so that you're not leveraging yourself out of existence.
I think that you guys give some amazing advice. I mean, any other parting words that you have for, you know, sellers, or anything else you'd like to share a little bit about your firm?
I guess just the number one thing for us is starting with the customer and working backwards. It's something that every Amazon employee hears from the first meeting that you attend, the first orientation that you attend, through every single meeting basically that happens, is what would the customer think? Yeah. And the projects are written with, you know, a press release in mind, because you're trying to think about how the customer would feel about your project. There's documentation that says, would the customer pay for this? You know, there's a whole bunch of things where it's all about the customer. What would the customer do? What would the customer want? And sellers often are not having that mindset. And in fact, we had one seller who referred to their customers as these people. I was like, oh, okay, I don't think you quite get how this works. These people pay your bills. So that focus, really treating the customer as the primary here. You need that customer to want to buy your stuff. Amazon needs that customer to want to buy your stuff, because that's how they make the 15%. Everyone needs to focus on the customer here. Yep. The one who wants to go on Amazon to buy the stuff and to not return the stuff. That's really what the goal is here.
Well, and to invoke Emily, I will say what she said at SCO. Jeff always had said, pay attention to your competitors. Obsess about your customers. Because that's where it's at. The empty chair next to you is your customer. That's what you pay attention to. Don't worry about what Bob down the street is doing with his business. Worry about what your customers think. When you do that as a seller on Amazon, you are automatically upping your success ratio by an order of magnitude, because you're focusing on the right thing.
And I think that even applies off Amazon. That even applies if you're selling on a different website, you're going to open a brick and mortar, you're going to open a food truck. Being customer obsessed, there's a reason why Amazon, you know, has adopted that policy and why it's been so successful. So, you know, being customer obsessed does pay off, even if it might seem like a short-term hassle. So you guys have given so much great information. Again, think Cascadia.com, and it's Cascadia Seller Solutions. Thank you. And we're going to have Emily come back on, because her mic broke during the middle of it. But thank you so much, Kelly and Rachel, for coming on. This has been another episode of the Unstoppable Entrepreneur Show, where we give you actionable advice for your e-commerce business, and have a prosperous week.
Thank you for listening to the Unstoppable Entrepreneur Show with Robin Johnson. If you think this show is the bee's knees, then the best way to keep Robin making more episodes is to subscribe to the show on iTunes and leave a review. As much fun as it is to listen to Robin, we can promise you that you won't make any money if you don't get in the action. If you're ready to start taking some serious action to start or grow your e-commerce business, join our Unstoppable Amazon Academy. You get a special offer for just being a listener. Go to bestfromthenest.com/show. We all know how Robin loves a deal, so we're giving you one. We're giving you a 3-day free trial so that you can make sure the Academy is right for you. Then your price is only $34.99 a month, or $245 a year. Psst! I didn't want to tell this to the other listeners, but you seem pretty cool. So to see how working directly with Robin and her team could benefit your business, and to see if you qualify to work directly with Robin, go to bestfromthenest.com/show. Don't tell anybody I told you.